cybercrime, macroeconomic conditions, ESG reporting. You can't predict the future, but you can prepare for it. By understanding your risk, you can make your business resilient to challenges on the road ahead. What's more, you can turn those risks into opportunities. EY helps CFOs, boards, and audit committees see beyond the numbers to uncover the critical insights that make their organizations resilient, even in an ever-shifting landscape. For more insights that matter, visit ey.com/beyondthenumbers.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Take's Tim Stenovek. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
The Bloomberg exclusive from Jeff Feely, Michelle F. Davis, and Paul Seligson about Elon Musk and Twitter, the resolution said to stick on debt contingency issues. This crossing the Bloomberg terminal just moments ago.
According to those familiar with the matter, we're talking about financing the deal. So let's get to it. The latest in this story, the twists and turns, with Bloomberg News legal reporter Jeff Feely. He is on the phone in Wilmington, Delaware. So, Jeff, what's the latest? What's the update?
We're trying to reach the end on this, but as usual, the devil is in the details. They're trying to hammer out sort of the final terms of the, you know, the procedural finalization of Twitter's suit over Mr. Musk's attempt to try to walk away from the deal. And the sticking point at this point is a financing contingency that Mr. Musk included in an SEC letter outlining his offer to revive the deal on its original terms. And, you know, that's not in the original deal, and the Twitter folks are not happy about that.
So what does this mean for the chances of it actually closing? I mean, does this give Elon Musk some sort of...
It's going to close. It's going to close. There's no question it's going to close.
Is it going to close at $54.20 a share?
Absolutely. Twitter has won. Mr. Musk waved the white flag. He capitulated. He surrendered. It's over.
Well, I got to tell you, the stock shares of Twitter are below $54.20 a share at $50 and change. It's down about 2.3% here. So what happens next legally? You know, this is the thing that you're keeping a watch on. And I feel like from the get-go, Elon laid out his deal, said, I'm all in, don't need to do a lot of extra stuff. And then all of a sudden it started backtracking it. From a legal perspective, as you said, is there any grounds for him to stand on?
No. The reality is what they're doing now is trying to hammer out a request for the judge to stay the progress of the case, to basically put it on hold so they can finalize, you know, the procedural stuff they need to do. In the end, it's going to be a stipulation of dismissal. The lawsuit is going to go away. The deal's going to close. And then Twitter's going to be owned by Elon Musk.
Hey, I love in this reporting by you and our Bloomberg team that notes that for the banks involved, very few, if any, ways for banks to get out of providing such debt commitments after signing the contract. That's the other angle here.
Yes. Again, these are all legal agreements signed by very sophisticated investors with lots of legal talent. Agreements, you know, require you to honor your obligations. Same thing with Mr. Musk and his obligation to buy Twitter. He agreed to do it. He's now going to have to do it, and the banks are going to have to finance it.
Does it happen next week, Jeff?
Not a clue. Couldn't tell you. You know, you just can't predict how long this stuff's going to take.
So what's the point of adding language like this, like Elon Musk did and his team did, to this letter filed with the SEC? Why add this language?
because lawyers are paid to protect their clients.
Right.
And they did not know for sure whether the original debt deal was still going to fly, given the changes in the market that we've reported. So lawyers are going to protect their clients. If for some reason this financing fell apart, then Mr. Musk would have the legal right to sue those folks for that financing.
All right. So yesterday, so much when we were having conversations about Elon Musk and his pursuit, not pursuit of Twitter, we were saying, you know, it's not quite done yet. And here we are again having another story about it not being done quite yet. But you were saying it's going to happen. Are we getting to the end of the ability of Elon Musk's lawyers to kind of just put a pause on it?
Yeah, look, it's not really Elon Musk's lawyers. What's happening here is that people need to figure out last steps. You can't just have an offer and then everybody throws their hands up, has a party, and goes home. You've got to finalize it. You got to make sure that everything, all the I's are dotted and the T's are crossed, and that's what's going on. So everybody really needs to calm down. This is done.
Yeah.
Hey, Jeff, don't give away your sources or your methods, of course, but what are you looking for to be, I don't know, the next shoe to drop between now and when this closes?
All right, the next shoe to drop. Again, I'm a legal guy, so the next shoe to drop is going to be a request to Judge McCormick here in Wilmington to stay the trial. Trial is set to go October 17th, and Judge McCormick noted yesterday that nobody has yet asked for a stay, so they're going to continue to proceed like the trial's going to go October 17th. It's not going to go on October 17th. They're going to file a request to put it on hold so that they can have time to do the finalization they need to do. When that's done, you're going to have a stipulation of dismissal, and the Twitter suit will go away, and the deal will close.
Gotta love it. One for the business schools to study for a long time.
Not yet, though. The story's still being written, Carol.
That's right. We haven't gotten to the end of it.
Don't forget the law schools. They may be interested, too.
Really, really good point. And you've been so smart on all of it and keeping us updated. Jeff Feely, thank you so much. Bloomberg News legal reporter Jeff Feely there in Wilmington, Delaware. Again, the headline, talks between Elon Musk and Twitter to reach a resolution on that $44 billion takeover, stuck in part over Musk's statement that his offer is now contingent on receiving $13 billion in debt financing. This is according to people familiar with the matter. Shares a Twitter down here on the news.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
We're also talking about the latest on Credit Suisse, because this is the most read story on the Bloomberg. Today, it's a Bloomberg exclusive about Credit Suisse eyeing outside money for a spinoff when it comes to the company's investment banking business.
Very pleased this afternoon to be joined.
Smashing picnic pumpkins over this.
I don't know. Mean, you can't say that without me thinking of the 90s rock band, you know, with Billy Corgan, the Smashing Pumpkins. But back to Credit Suisse, we got Shanali Basak right here. She's Wall Street reporter for Bloomberg News. She's with us right now in the Bloomberg Interactive Brokers Studio. Shanali, we saw a lot from Credit Suisse over the weekend, the CEO coming out late last week and over the weekend, trying to assuage concerns from investors and clients as well. Bring us up to speed on this report.
A few things happening. We've been talking about it. End of the month, Credit Suisse will give a fuller strategy update here. And fits and starts, things are starting to leak out about what they're considering. The investment banking part of this, some fun stats, guys. If you think that Credit Suisse has been under a lot of pressure this year, yes, of course it has. Shares down more than 50%, downgrades, cost of funding rising. But they are still one of the top six in mergers and acquisitions, according to Bloomberg's league tables. They're also among the top 10 in most forms of important debt underwriting. That means in U.S. investment grade credit. It means even high yields. It's only leveraged loans. They've really fallen off a bit. And remember, that's a riskier business in which a lot of people are losing money anyways. So they are holding on tight to that investment bank as far as they can, as long as they can. And if they were to raise outside capital for it, potentially spin it off, maybe they can raise enough money to avoid what investors are really worried about, which is a capital raise.
So, which would explain to, I mean, our audience knows, but explain what that would mean for Credit Suisse if that happens.
Listen, so Credit Suisse, restructurings are expensive.
Right.
It would require some firings, for example, maybe exiting some businesses. It can cost millions, hundreds of millions of dollars to restructure banks. Citigroup is doing it right now, for example. So if you're Credit Suisse, you may need to raise money. And if you have to do that in the stock market through new equity, it would dilute your stock. And so investors are concerned about that event. Now, analysts out there believe that $4 billion $4 billion is about what might need to be raised, but maybe some of that $4 billion can be obtained elsewhere mm-hmm. by selling some assets, perhaps by maybe doing this investment banking weird deal that we've been talking about.
Right.
But long story short, is what they're trying to do is get enough money to fund this plan, this turnaround plan.
Can I ask you something though? Does it? I don't know. I guess I keep thinking of the city model, right? Like so much under one roof and it allows you to do so much. What does it take away from Credit Suisse if they get rid of investment banking? Does it matter?
So this is the age-old question. I love this question because it's a bank question a lot of banks face. UBS has faced this question for a very long time. Deutsche Bank has even faced it. Mm-hmm. The reality is in times where your wealth manager is under stress, your investment bank is making you a lot of money.
Right.
So it is a ballast when things go good or bad, depending. But remember, Credit Suisse, we're not talking about a small firm. We're talking about a top 10 player in the world.
Well, that brings me to my next question, Shanali. If we look at the struggles that Credit Suisse is facing, is this a Credit Suisse-specific issue? Are these Credit Suisse-specific issues, or is this something that investors should be concerned about affecting other banks as well?
It's a great question because a lot of these issues are Credit Suisse-specific. They've lost a lot of money in Archegos with Greensill. Mm-hmm. These are really bad investments and soured clients, essentially. So they do have unique issues to themselves, plus lots of risk management issues over a lot of years that have piled up. But to that end, a lot of European banks are under a lot of pressure, given the pressures we're seeing in Europe at large. So if you take a look at Barclays stock, for example, it's trading well below book value, as is Credit Suisse. So yes, there is a broader worry about European banks, but right now this is not to the concern of any sort of breaking point yet. You know, the idea mm-hmm. of a Lehman moment was a lot of things that a lot of more professional money managers were shaking off.
You mentioned the stock decline this year, so down more than 50%. So obviously investors don't have a lot of faith right now, but what about this current CEO who has had some stumbles, right, with these memos that have come out and not necessarily done the right thing? So is there faith from the analyst community at large that he's the guy to fix it?
Well, you hope so, because they've had so much management turnover already.
Right.
And so really the last thing you need for Credit Suisse is another pair of uncertainties on top of everything else they're facing. So, yes, is there pressure on him? Yes. Given that he just got there, he has a little bit.
I was just going to say, right? He just got there.
Yeah, he just got there. And so he has time on his hands. But how much is time? A year? 12 months? 2 years?
Yeah.
What about when it comes to staffing and when it comes to talent acquisition, talent mm-hmm. wars? It's not what it was a year ago when it comes to investment banks, when it comes to banks worldwide or you know, here in the U.S. is more the story that I focused on. But when you think about it worldwide, do these issues really hurt retention at the bank?
Yes. To your point, it's not as easy now as it was a year ago. And we have seen a lot of bankers leave Credit Suisse, for example, over mm-hmm. the last couple of years. However, you know, now I'm pushing this beyond Credit Suisse. I have been having a lot of conversations on the buy side, big private equity funds who are looking at the banks like Credit Suisse, seeing who's left there and saying, okay, maybe some of these folks that worked in leveraged finance or worked in equity capital markets can come work for us instead, as we build up certain businesses when, frankly, assets are on the cheap and hiring is under pressure, so we can get even people for a better price.
Real quickly, just got about 30 seconds, the Swiss government.
Yes.
Could they help out here? Or
I'm sure they are knocking on their door all the time because this is a gem of Switzerland.
How's it going? Yeah,
But if anything, if they nudge anything to happen, you have to wonder if they're going to ask certain parts of Credit Suisse to merge with any part of UBS or any other bank.
All right. Do we expect a resolution at next couple of weeks or
next
what?
Couple of weeks, we'll get the big plan, the
big dream.
But you have to hope that it's big enough to make investors happy.
All right. Good stuff, as always. Shanali Basak, she's Wall Street reporter at Bloomberg News. The latest on Credit Suisse, as we mentioned, it is the most read story on the Bloomberg on this. What day is it?
It's Thursday, Lemon. Friday's Eve.
All right. You're listening and watching Bloomberg Business Week on radio, on YouTube, and this is Bloomberg.
When cyber criminals strike, the difference between a catastrophic event and resilience is preparedness. Finance leaders who plan ahead can thwart the damage posed by ransomware. Yet in a recent EY poll, only 23% of directors expressed confidence in their organization's ability to respond to a ransomware attack. Cyber preparedness is just one facet of the complex risk landscape finance leaders face every day. Now more than ever, it's vital to keep ahead of developments. Cybercrime, macroeconomic conditions, ESG reporting. You can't predict the future, but you can prepare for it. By understanding your risk, you can make your business resilient to challenges on the road ahead. What's more, you can turn those risks into opportunities. EY helps CFOs, boards, and audit committees see beyond the numbers to uncover the critical insights that make their organizations resilient, even in an ever-shifting landscape. For more insights that matter, visit ey.com/beyondthenumbers.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest-growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle-market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing. The passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's STIFEL.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Well, a report in August from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services showed that the national uninsured rate reached an all-time low of 8% earlier this year. Some good news, with 5.2 million having gained coverage since 2020. Meantime, a Commonwealth Fund survey found that 43% of working-age adults were inadequately insured this year. That both includes uninsured and underinsured. 23% alone, Tim, were underinsured, meaning their coverage just didn't provide them with affordable access to health care.
Yeah, perhaps a huge deductible that you have to reach in order, in order for that insurance to actually kick in. Let's get into it with Ji Bai, professor of health policy and management at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Ji joins us on the phone from Washington, D.C. this afternoon. Ji, good to have you with us. What exactly is the definition of underinsured in the U.S.? Because it doesn't necessarily mean that you don't have insurance. It doesn't mean you don't have insurance. It just means that you're paying a lot, right?
Exactly. So that means you have a high deductible plan, that before the deductible kick in, you are paying dollar for dollar for the negotiated price that has been determined between your insurance plan and the provider. So in theory, you are insured, but you just have a very high exposure before your deductible kicks in.
Would you consider anyone who has a high deductible health plan to be underinsured, or is it okay, and I know you can't give individual advice, but is it okay for somebody who is, very young and healthy to have a high deductible health care plan?
Absolutely. And also, when we talk about the vulnerability, it's linked to the person's income. Right? If you're a very wealthy person, you don't care. You can always pay. But it's really troubling for low-income working Americans with high deductible plans, because these people are really vulnerable financially.
So what about Obamacare, right, in terms of the impact that that's had? Has it made it better?
Great question. The Obamacare is really for the individual market, right? For people who are eligible to receive subsidy, they are well protected. But there are many people, their income's above the threshold, so they're not getting the subsidy, and then, the price can be very high for them.
I'm always amazed, Tim, when I talk with individuals, and especially like in the media community, we have a lot of freelance folks, and either if they're young, they tend to be like, I don't need insurance, or I can't afford it. Or if they have families, either what they're paying or that their deductibles are just so high.
I think one of the big concerns is that it's expensive to get really comprehensive coverage,
right?
And it's going to get more expensive, G. We're at a time when we're talking open enrollment is starting to happen for next year for many companies that follow a, typical four-quarter, first through fourth quarter, January through December type of thing. What should we expect to see when it comes to healthcare costs going up? And are we expecting some companies not to shoulder as much of those costs, so employees are going to have to end up paying more?
That's such a great point, Tim. The inflation will eventually affect the healthcare sector. So we are expecting to see a substantial increase on the both Obamacare market and also on the private insurance market. So the companies, if they have a lot of money, have deep pocket, they would be willing to shoulder more. But, nowadays many companies are struggling, so they will have to shovel a lot of the burden on individual workers and their family.
Help me out here. I am always like, I feel tortured when I think about the healthcare space because you have a lot of managed care companies. They're publicly held companies, so they have to think about their shareholders and making money. I think about these massive hospital organizations. They're nonprofits, but yet I do feel like they have to think a lot about the bottom line. So as long as there is a bottom line component to healthcare, and we need to be cost aware, right? But as long as that's there, are there always going to be people left out because it's either too expensive and ultimately inaccessible?
Yes. I would say as long as we have good competition, right, and then the price will eventually go down and the quality will be maintained. And then we also at the same time have to have a good safety net system to protect the people who are most in need and who are most vulnerable.
All right, we're going to leave it on that note. Really something to think about with everything that's going on, but this is really something that impacts people on such a key level. Jibai, thank you so much. Professor of Health Policy and Management at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, of course, supported by Michael R. Bloomberg, founder of Bloomberg LP and Bloomberg Philanthropies. She was joining us on the phone from Washington, D.C.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
The new issue of Bloomberg Business Week is out. This week's cover story is in the magazine's features section. It's about what were supposed to be the future, or was supposed to be the future, and instead prominent detractors are getting louder as the losses get bigger. By the way, it's also the Bloomberg Big
Take. Did you take a self-driving car here this morning?
No, I did not.
Have you ever taken a self-driving car anywhere?
I pretend when I take my hands off the wheel.
All right, we're not going to talk about that. That's like on the record now. Max Chafkin wrote the story. He's a columnist for Bloomberg Business Week. He's with us right now in the Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio. We also got with us the editor of the magazine, Joel Weber. He's with us in the Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio. Joel, I joke, but the fact of the matter is here we are in 2022, and we were supposed to have self-driving cars by now. What happened?
Well, $100 billion later, that's the real question. Because there have been some really prominent companies that have gotten into this space and obviously thrown a lot of money at it. But there's not much revenue to actually show for that investment so far. And that's really the thesis that Max hits on here. And now that those losses are getting bigger, the detractors are getting louder, and it really calls into question, you know, what this self-driving future might even look like, or if it will ever come to pass. And I think that what Max explores is that there are applications for self-driving, but it may not be exactly what we've been pitched, right, Max?
Yeah, exactly. If you go back maybe a decade ago to TED and these conferences, you had everyone basically going around, and in particular Google, kind of leading the charge, but also lots of automakers, lots of technologists. Basically, everybody saying, hey, you know, my kid's 10 and, you know, they're never going to need a driver's license. And that really became baked almost like conventional wisdom, not just among technologists, but among policymakers, consultants, everywhere. And you saw basically about 5 years ago this amazing explosion of investment, not just Google and Cruise, but smaller companies, basically everyone throwing billions into this field. And a lot of that money's gone nowhere. We've seen a lot of stocks either crash, in the case of Aurora, which is one of these kind of bubbly self-driving companies, or you know, in the case of a company like Zoox, which was super hyped, and then it kind of got swallowed up by Amazon. So there's just been a lot of kind of you know, difficulty in the industry.
Okay, so one of the sources in the story who has become something of a detractor is a name that we haven't really heard from him in a while, and that's Anthony Lewandowski. Who is Anthony Lewandowski, and what did he have to tell you?
So he is, you know, one of the most interesting people in self-driving cars. He was, for a really long time, I mean, you know, leading the charge that I was just talking about how great driverless cars are going to be. He is really the person who created to the extent that one person created the Google self-driving car, or even the industry, it was him. And he went through this weird, very controversial journey. He went to Uber and then got caught up in this massive, you know, multi-billion-dollar litigation mm-hmm. over alleged trade secrets theft. Wound up with criminal charges. He pled guilty, and then he was pardoned on the last day of the Trump presidency. And he's kind of come out the other end, obviously, with tons of baggage, very controversial, but sort of saying some things out loud that I think people in the industry were saying quietly for a very long time, and that is, this is not going as well as we wanted it to go.
What's incredible about this guy is he's the one who sort of created the first version of
autonomous vehicle, right? You described this situation years ago where he took a Toyota Prius and got it to move across. Was it the Bay Bridge?
Yeah. And it was for, it's funny, it was for a reality show. So, I mean, in this kind of driverless car world, he was sort of the scrappy entrepreneur, the one who was kind of trying to push it to commercialize. He took, as you said, he created a sort of hacked together a Prius, drove it across the Bay Bridge, and then that basically got swallowed up into Google, became the Google driverless car.
But now he's doing something that is, you could argue, is sort of, I don't know, less complicated than that when it comes to the application of EVs, essentially using them on an industrial standpoint.
And that's right. And this actually, I think, you know, it's a part of the article that's kind of interesting, is like maybe self-driving cars do have a practical purpose.
Yeah.
But again, it doesn't look like what we've been told about, you know, having a robo-taxi pull up outside your home or driving you to the office or you doing all that and then sending your vehicle off somewhere to, like, run around and make money right for you all day. It actually looks like, well, maybe a mining application, Max?
Yeah. So Lewandowski's company is doing what they call autonomous haulage, basically driverless dump trucks. It sounds maybe harder than driverless cars, but you got to remember, these are closed sites. These trucks are basically just going back and forth. I mean, they very much are, like, it's more like conventional robotics. And I think the one thing that kind of opened my eyes as writing this thing is there's been a lot of hype on driverless cars and the sort of robo-taxi narrative that we all thought was going to be worth trillions of dollars, cause Cathie Wood to, you know, value Tesla, you know, at, I don't know, in the many trillions of dollars. That, I think there's a lot of questions, but there's been huge advances on kind of more day-to-day autonomy. So we're talking about advanced driver assistance, ADAS, which is now like in every new car. It's, you know, dramatically changed the driving experience. It's a big part of Elon Musk's strategy with Tesla. And then we have these autonomous industrial applications, what Anthony Lewandowski is doing with mining. But of course, it's also happening in agriculture. It's happening in lots of industries that really no one's paying attention to.
Can we talk about the Derek Zoolander problem? It's my favorite point. We've been talking about it in the newsroom.
So, yeah.
Playing the video.
That's what you were referring to. I was like,
Tim, I'm like, come on.
Well, yeah, anyway. He can't. Yeah. I won't give it away.
So self-driving cars have lots of problems. I mean, one of the challenges for self-driving cars is there are all these parts of driving that they struggle with, one of which is what the industry calls an unprotected left turn. This is a left turn that's not, not one lane to one lane or not with a left turn signal. And it's kind of funny because
it could be an ambi-turner.
Like any normal driver just calls that a left. And it's just like Derek Zoolander kind of rebranding not being able to turn left as like, I'm not an ambi-turner. But I think that's one of those jokes you have to be a certain age to.
Don't worry. I think three of the four of us.
I'm in.
It's an important, right? Like,
no, absolutely. And it's one of these things where, you know, if you listen to the industry, they're saying, hey, there are these edge cases, these things nobody thinks about. And one of these things that they are talking about as an edge case is basically left turns. So like, really, like, there are just a lot of problems that the industry has, and they're just so far away from mastery that I think this discussion we've had where people have been saying, oh, they're 99% of the way there, they just need to get that one more percent. It's I think it's very hard to say with any kind of certainty that's the ratio, that's the number.
Okay. I know for research purposes, you spend a lot of time watching YouTube videos of autonomous cars doing things they're not supposed to do. And I'm wondering, of all the ones that you got to watch, what was your favorite?
So my favorite is, it's the lead of the story. It's this happened in San Francisco last year. There's a woman, she lives on a quiet street in San Francisco, and just every day for like 50 times a day for several weeks, cars were making U-turns in her driveway. And really, it only stopped because, like, she called the local news. Local news came, like, the problem solvers came and solved her problem. And finally, you know, Waymo tweaked their algorithm. The crazy thing about this is, if you read the story, you'll see Waymo's response to this is like, yeah, we're just following the local laws, which I think is true. There's like, in all of these cases, there are difficulties, but it's like, if you're having this kind of problem, you got to question some things.
It's an incredible read. Check it out. It's the cover story. Max Chafkin, thank you so much. And of course, our thanks to the editor of Bloomberg Business Week, Joel Weber. Check it out. The new issue of Bloomberg Business Week. It is out.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
We've got another one of the most read stories on the Bloomberg today. It's about how the U.S. Central Bank, of course, we're talking about the U.S. Federal Reserve, has a poor record when it comes to forecasting joblessness around downturns. It isn't easy, I guess.
It's not easy, but it's not a great record. As Reed Pickard and Craig Torres write, Fed officials have failed to correctly predict how high joblessness would increase during or in the wake of almost every recession over the past 50 years. Reed Pickard is U.S. economy reporter for Bloomberg News. She's in our 99.1 studio in Washington, D.C. Follow her on Twitter. At Reed P, R-E-A-D-E-P. Reed, good to have you with us this afternoon. So why is this so difficult for the Fed to do? As I said, these are some smart cookies we got there.
Yeah, it's good to be here. And, you know, it's important to think about. So when we were deciding to write this story, how it came to be is because Craig and I were looking at their forecasts. And the thing that stuck out to us was, you know, not necessarily that unemployment was going to increase to 4.4% next year. It was the fact that it was going to stay there. And recessions more generally are very difficult to predict. And part of that is stems from this dynamic that you see in the unemployment rate. So usually when the unemployment rate starts going up, it keeps going up. And the Fed has it sticking there in these forecasts. And the reason for that dynamic usually, and what you've seen in past recessions, and why in the case that the Fed has undershot a lot of where the unemployment rate has ultimately gone, is you get this dynamic where there's some layoffs, and then, you know, you see your neighbor get laid off. And so you pull back on your spending. And then when you pull back on your spending, then suddenly there's less business at all of these other businesses. And they start laying off people. And that leads to more people out of work and more people pulling back on their spending. And so it becomes this, you know, this feedback loop that's, you know, really hard to stop once it gets going, which is why you tend to see that dynamic of it keeps going past, you know, where, you know, the Fed expects and where a lot of people expect during recessions.
I gotta say, Reed, this plays into something we were talking about with our Mike McKee earlier, who follows international economics and policy, of course. But I said, you know, okay, we know how high inflation is. How quickly does it come down on the other side? And this whole, this feedback loop, like I do wonder, like you say, that once these numbers start to be negative, people see it and the sentiment just starts to impact a broader swath, if you will, and that those numbers start to accelerate. And that's kind of what you're saying, right?
That's exactly what I'm saying on the unemployment front. You know, it'll be interesting to see what happens on the price front because, right, you know, businesses tend to be a little more likely, I guess, maybe to lay someone off than they are to slash prices out of nowhere. So you tend to see a bit quicker of a response in terms of the labor component of the costs that a lot of businesses have. But, you know, the Fed has really showed and said over and over again that they're dedicated to tamping down inflation, and that will likely be a painful experience for Americans. And so a lot of that is likely to come through job losses. But that's not to say that it has to be that way. And there's still, well, as Fed officials will say, there's still a potential path. It's just getting nearer.
What about this whole idea, though, Reed, that it's been hard for companies to find workers, right? That is another story that we continue to say over and over again. So might they be a little less reluctant to let somebody go at this point, only because they're so afraid they're not going to be able to get that worker when they need them?
Absolutely. So economists typically think of that as something called labor hoarding. And it's exactly that. These businesses that for the last 2 years have worked so hard to not only attract workers, but retain them and have paid a lot to do so in terms of wage increases, that, you know, if they see a potential downturn as being shallow or not very long, that they're going to hold on to those workers, you know, especially given the fact that a lot of businesses are still operating at understaffed levels. So that is actually one of the main arguments that's put forward in terms of why you might see a cap on unemployment, why even though these Federal Reserve forecasts look a little odd, it's one of kind of the main arguments for why you could actually see unemployment move up some, but not run away as it has in past downturns.
So what do you hear from not necessarily Fed officials, Reid, but close watchers of the American economy, people who've studied this in the past, as far as actually being able to pull off, and Carol, don't get mad when I say this, a soft landing. That is the idea of,
as long as you don't use pivot, I'm
raising
okay.
interest rates without causing massive unemployment, just in the last 30 seconds that we have.
Yeah. So it's actually really interesting because among a lot of the banks, you're really split. So it's a lot of folks see that, you know, a recession is kind of the only way to get prices under control in terms of the rate that the Fed is hiking. But the argument more generally for this potential soft landing, I think, really kind of came to bear earlier this week when we saw job openings, which have been at historically high levels. We saw them drop by over a million
right.
in a month.
Yeah.
And so the idea, you know, theoretically, you might be able to get there if you see job openings fall enough that you start to see
right.
those wage pressures really abate. And you might be able to do it without a lot
yeah.
of job losses.
And yeah, we'll get some more info on that tomorrow, too, with, of course, the monthly jobs report. Reid Picker, U.S. economy reporter for Bloomberg News and our 99 at 1 studio.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
Yeah, how about you let me drive?
Oh, no, 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 no.
Who's going to drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, everybody, just about 9.5 minutes left in today's trading session. We have been bouncing around, but we are well, well off our best levels of the session. In fact, hovering just off our lows of the session. So let's get to it with our Drive to the Close guest.
We got Jessica Beamer joining us. She's portfolio manager at Easterly Investment Partners. Jessica joining us this afternoon on the phone from Pennsylvania. Jessica, good to have you with us. How are you?
Hey, Tim, how are you?
We're doing pretty well, trying to figure out what earnings season is going to look like and hoping that you can shed a little light on that. Before we do get there, though, we get those jobs numbers tomorrow. Help us understand, you know, how to make sense of the economic data we've been getting this week and Fed officials banging the drum saying we've got a ways to go when it comes to tamping down inflation.
Yeah, I think it's a great question, and I think we're still in the stages where we're collecting data and trying to see some early signs of the Fed impact. I think when we're looking at the data this week, whether it's what we've already seen or what we expect to see tomorrow, I think we all have to understand that we're only going to get early hints of the Fed's full impact. A lot of the efforts that they've put out there, obviously huge increases in the interest rate, but that takes time to work its way through the economy and certainly on the jobs numbers that we're going to see. So, you know, we expect to see some continued improvements increases in wage. But at the same time, I'm not sure if we can really take that data and read into it in terms of what the Fed is going to do, because we know that the Fed is looking out at the long term, and they, you know, it takes a few months for their efforts to end up in these numbers.
All right. So, Jessica, we know the S&P 500 before this week's 2-day rally pushed it higher. It was very oversold. If you look at some of the technicals like an RSI, relative strength index. So we bounced off that level, but now we're trending lower again. How do you think about the bottom for equities?
Yeah, I think that's really the ultimate question here. And, you know, the last few weeks, I'd say the last 5 weeks have been really interesting. There's kind of three things I would point out. First, you know, investors have begun to acknowledge that the sell-off we've seen so far this year is not temporary. I think there was a narrative earlier this year that we needed a quick valuation correction and that the S&P would kind of rebalance and move on. Clearly, with the S&P down 25% through the first three quarters of 2022, all of that decline related to PE multiple compression, investors, I think, are starting to realize that it's going to be a down year. And that perhaps is driving some tax loss selling or just some capitulation. And I think, honestly, there's an effort to really diversify portfolios. It's about time because growth is still pretty much in line with its long-term average in terms of PE, and value stocks are a lot cheaper. So I think there's still this kind of emotional reaction to having a down year. Secondly, interest rates have really been a dominant story since mid-August, and it's created some panic in equity markets around housing, M&A financing, rolling debt. I think people are really worried about kind of how those rates are going to affect individual companies. So that has been an issue. I think we've seen some moderation in the last few days. I don't really want to say we're done worrying about interest rates, but that's going to be a dominant issue. And then thirdly, companies have started to preview their earnings reports for third quarter and provide guidance for the fourth quarter. I think that's going to have a pretty significant impact on what the bottom looks like for the S&P. Mm-hmm. I'm actually really excited to hear from companies because they are able to really give us, obviously, some perhaps short-term negatives, but long-term guidance on how they plan to react to the current environment. That tends to be a good thing for stocks. And I think a lot of companies that have reported so far, even bad news, people are able to process that and put it into their models and then move on. So I think next week as we move into earnings, we'll start to hear more about 2023 and long-term plans. And I think that's ultimately going to help stocks in the long run.
Well, but if it doesn't help stocks, if it only helps stocks if we hear, optimistic news about what 2023 looks like.
But what if we have CEOs say, okay, it doesn't look good, but that's the worst of it?
It's kind of like what Gina Martin Adams said about the Bloomberg Intelligence analysis of earnings transcripts that she saw, right? In the first quarter, they mentioned inflation more than in the second quarter.
Right, right.
Yeah, I would say that uncertainty is probably the worst thing for stocks.
Yeah.
And so even if it's bad news, I think people are able to at least say, okay, this is the information. Here's some concrete numbers that I can put into a model. I understand where the management team plans to go over the next 12 months, and they can understand the strategies going forward. I think it's much harder when we don't have any information and we just sit here worrying about it. So I would be, if there's a management team listening, I would say please be as specific as possible about your plans for your individual company. I think any effort by management teams to put off concrete guidance is going to be problematic.
Yeah, companies. Don't tell me you don't have any visibility because then I'm running for the hills.
Right.
Hey, listen, in the meantime, Jessica, are there or what do you see as the best opportunity for investors who do have some money that they want to put to work right now? Is it cash? Is it cash-like? Or is it something?
We've heard a lot of that this week.
Yeah, right? We have.
A lot of people are going back into cash. And, I understand that, is a nice, safe place to be most of the time. But I would say that from our perspective, there are still places within the market that offer outsized opportunities. Financials are still a pretty well-positioned to benefit from rising rates. And historically, financials have been a safe haven in these types of markets where inflation is rising and people are worried about the economy. It is hard to imagine financials as a safe haven because there are a lot of components of those businesses that are very GDP sensitive. But I don't think investors truly appreciate the power of increasing rates and increasing net interest income and the amount of the operating leverage that we can see at those banks as rates go up. We had a taste of it last quarter. Mm-hmm. We'll see a lot more of it this quarter. The other area we're still really bullish on is energy. It's benefiting from, increased commodity prices, strong free cash flow, increased dividend
payments. It's the only major industry group in the S&P 500, there are 11, that is up this year, and it is up 50%. We understand why, but you would still find opportunity.
Yeah. I think we are. And, I think it comes from the fact that it's still a pretty underowned part of the market. And, I think our long-term view is that this that energy is still going to be an essential part of our economy, whether it's renewable energy or oil and gas. I think these are all very important parts of our economy, and it's just simply under-owned.
Jessica Beamer, portfolio manager at Easterly Investment Partners, on the phone from Pennsylvania.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
And you can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.